Hey, strangers, before we jump into today's episode, just a note to let you know that my new contract with my ad seller requires 4 ad breaks per episode now. I am doing my best to make the episodes longer to accommodate. I know no one loves ads, but them's the breaks in capitalism. Remember, there are a few options if you want to skip the ads. You can always do it manually, or you can now subscribe through Apple Podcasts and become a casual stranger where you'll get early and ad-free regular episodes, plus the new Strange News Weekly Addendum. Or you can sign up on Patreon at patreon.com/grabbadcollab, where for just $8 a month, you'll get early and ad-free Strange, plus all the other amazing content at GrabBag, all ad-free. We have 3 regular weekly shows and a whole handful of quarterly miniseries and bi-weekly shows, all for just $8 a month. See you there, and enjoy. What does it take to survive? When you're faced with almost certain death, do you have what it takes to push through? What if all you needed to make it was a phantom cheerleader? Someone no one else can see or hear, telling you, you got this. Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. By now, you all know I'm not the intrepid type. Perhaps when I was younger, my joints all moved right and I had more energy and I didn't know the dangers inherent in being anywhere other than tucked into my nice cozy bed. I've also never had an imaginary friend. Nor have I heard voices that weren't there other than the constant drone of all the critical things anyone has ever said to me, playing on a loop in my head. And so, if I were in danger, I don't know that I'd make it. In an adventure gone horribly wrong, would I be able to summon the strength and the courage to carry on? Would I be able to summon a whole other person who would pick me up and tell me to get the hell up and keep going? Toward the end of what was called the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, when intrepid men were still trying to explore parts unknown, or semi-known, for whatever glory came with discovering these parts, an Irishman named Sir Ernest Shackleton decided he would be the first person in recorded history to cross Antarctica by land. Don't ask me why. I don't like to be in a vertical position for much longer than is absolutely necessary, and I certainly don't like being even the least bit cold. I see myself as a pioneer of the heroic age of resting. Someday, maybe they'll write a book about me. Anyway, Shackleton and his crew of 28, a cat and some sled dogs, sailed to the threshold of Antarctica in late October 1914. By January, the ship was hopelessly stuck in pack ice in the Weddell Sea. There was nothing they could do but wait for, I don't know, the ice to melt? Someone to notice they were gone much longer than anticipated and go rescue them? God to show up in a helicopter? I guess they must have had a way to signal other people, what with Morse code and everything. Cuneiform? Smoke signals? Whether or not anyone knew they were stuck out there, Shackleton and his crew waited there on the ship, stuck in the ice, for 9 months. 9 months! On October 27, 1915, with the ship taking on copious amounts of water, Shackleton ordered his crew off the ship. Each man could take 2 pounds of personal possessions with him. Crewman Frank Worsley was also allowed to save his camera. Another crewman was allowed to save his banjo. You know, the bare essentials. They all moved onto the surrounding ice and set up camp a mile or so away from the crippled ship. The crew tried, unsuccessfully, to find actual land while the ship got crushed by the surrounding ice and eventually sank like a stone into the sea. Finally, in April 1916, 6 months after they'd abandoned the ship, the ice began to break up and the crew hopped, or hobbled more likely, aboard the lifeboats they'd salvaged and sailed for a week and 100 miles to an uninhabited piece of land called Elephant Island. A week later, a few of the men decided to head out across this vast, snowy unknown to try to get help. So far, no helicopter from God. Shackleton and five others set out on a single reinforced lifeboat called the James Caird, but shit hit the fan pretty quick, with the little boat taking on too much water, high winds throwing them off course, and then a hurricane blew in right before they reached land 800 miles and 16 days later in what they guessed to be South Georgia. The men were sleep-deprived, exhausted, hungry, and in tatters. Somehow, Shackleton knew that across the island there was a whaling outpost, but the James Caird was in no shape to take them around, so they had to walk across the mountainous and yet strangely barren terrain, which he figured would take them around 2 days. It bears mentioning that they had very little food left at this point. Shackleton and two of the remaining men, who could actually realistically make the journey, at least more realistically than the others, set out for help. The trip was delayed by yet another storm, and finally, on May 19th, the men headed up the 3,000-foot-tall mountain. Once at the summit, they realized they had no choice but to slide their way down the other side, descending 3,000 feet in daredevil fashion in less than 5 minutes, which I suppose is easier on the knees, but maybe not so great on the butt. Shit did not get easier. With barely any sleep, the men trudged on. At one point, according to some versions of the story, they even had to risk their lives by pulling one of the men out of a frozen lake. That part might be apocryphal, but honestly, it's not even the most unbelievable thing they endured. They straggled into the whaling camp where no one recognized them, even though they'd stayed there 18 months earlier. Rescue was sent for the three men left on the other side of the South Georgian island. And then, 4 months after they'd been left on Elephant Island and more than 2 years after they'd left England, the rest of the crew was finally rescued when Shackleton borrowed a ship from the whaling camp and sailed back to get them. Somehow, every member of the expedition had survived. It wasn't until many years later, however, that something truly strange and unexplained was revealed. In his memoirs, Shackleton wrote, quote, "During that long and racking march of 36 hours over the unnamed mountains and glaciers of South Georgia, it seemed to me that we were four, not three," end quote. In other words, Shackleton knew there were only three men on that last trek over the mountains to rescue, but for some reason, it felt like there was another man with them. Even stranger, the other two men with him agreed that they had the same feeling. The feeling that someone else was with them as they slogged towards some kind of civilization. The men only revealed this to each other after the journey was over. For whatever reason, they had never discussed it before, probably for fear of being called crazy. But according to the Royal Geographical Society Journal, Frank Worsley, one of the three men on the trek, had this to say, quote, "There was indeed one thing about our crossing of South Georgia, a thing which I have never been able to explain. Whenever I reviewed the incidents of that march, I had the subconscious feeling that there were four of us instead of three," end quote. There is no record I could find that Shackleton and Worsley ever talked in detail about the additional member of the party, but it'd be interesting to know how similar or not their perceptions of this fourth man was. Shackleton called the fourth man a divine companion. He would always think of it as such. For all of Shackleton's accomplishments, especially those that had begun as failure, he never knew that this single recollection would stir the psychological pot, creating a whole new avenue of inquiry into what would become known as the third man factor. That is, the seeming appearance of someone by your side when you need them, even though you know, somewhere in your being, that they are not really there at all. Strangers, my favorite cat food to fantasize about feeding the fantasy stray kittens I find under my porch is back. Smalls Cat Food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients that you can find in your fridge. And it's delivered right to your door. That's right, no more going to the pet store and lugging giant bags of overly processed kibble or cases of stinky wet food filled with preservatives and fillers. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. Smalls was started back in 2017 by a couple of guys home cooking cat food in small batches for their friends. A few short years later, they've served millions of meals to cats across the U.S. Plus, Smalls works with the Humane World for Animals. They've donated over $1 million worth of food to help cats through the Humane World for Animals, and they even give you a chance to donate at checkout. Whether you donate $5 for flea and tick medication or $7 for vaccines, you can help a cat in need. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That's a big deal. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they'll give you a refund if your cat won't eat their food. What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve. For a limited time only, because you are a Strange and Unexplained listener, you can get 60% off your first Smalls order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/strange. That's 60% off when you head to smalls.com/strange plus free shipping. Again, that's smalls.com/strange. Canadian journalist, author, and shipwreck hunter John Geiger wrote The Third Man Factor, Surviving the Impossible, the seminal book about the third man phenomenon in 2009. He had previously written books about failed polar expeditions and grew intrigued by accounts that seemed to mirror the experience. He had tripped across the Shackleton account in the explorer's 1919 memoir entitled South. Geiger, who went on to do the gathering of a wide variety of similar stories from an even wider bunch of survivors, is given credit for giving a name to the phenomenon. But he was not the first to notice the commonality of the experiences. In 1955, MacDonald Critchley, a British neurologist, published his own collection of stories and wrote a paper titled The Idea of a Presence, based on a study he'd conducted back in 1943. As part of that research, he also interviewed hundreds of survivors of perilous journeys by sea or air. His June 1955 piece in an academic journal begins, quote, "The purpose of this article is to describe a rather unusual mental experience which may occur in some psychotics, rarely in epileptics as an aura, and even in normal persons in certain circumstances," end quote. Critchley wrote this paper and then moved on to other topics, leaving the heavy lifting on the idea of a presence for Geiger. Third Man Factor documents multiple instances of some kind of being showing up in perilous circumstances just to help. After Geiger found Shackleton's memoir about the guy who decided to join him and his cohorts as they desperately traversed the South Georgian island, he set out to find more examples of those who were convinced that someone showed up at exactly the right time to help them survive dire predicaments. While Geiger coined this phenomenon with the name the third man factor, I'll go ahead and call it the third person factor, for obvious reasons. The third person is not someone that can be conjured up by relatively well-adjusted people on a whim, generally speaking. Like, usually on a random Tuesday or whatever, being of sound mind and body, one can't just summon up an imaginary person in the coffee aisle at Kroger, you know? And if you can, you might want to consider speaking to a doctor. Not to other people who see or hear people that aren't really there, and if you do and it doesn't affect your day-to-day life, carry on. I'm actually a little jealous. I'm just saying, if you find yourself arguing over the qualities of medium roast over dark in the coffee aisle at Kroger with someone who's not actually there, it might be time to introduce an antipsychotic to your daily regimen. This phenomenon happens mostly in the direst of circumstances, when your only choices are to keep going or die. Think people climbing mountains in snowstorms, or those shipwrecked hopelessly on some spit of land that appears on no map anywhere. Or soldiers in mucky, bloody trenches, or while being trapped in earthquake debris for days. Still, the survivor stories have this one similarity, that someone, vague or familiar, shows up. It isn't a physical presence for most, mind you, but rather a feeling that someone is there. The appearance can be abrupt or come on slowly. Some of the survivors can't even pinpoint when the presence arrived. They just, at some point, realize they weren't alone. Here's a bit more scholarship, courtesy of the research database EBSCO. Quote, some people report the presence as vague and difficult to define, while others recognize it as a faraway or deceased loved one. Some climbers have also claimed to have encountered famous mountaineers, living or deceased, while stranded. In most circumstances, the external presence provides specific instructions that guide the distressed to safety, end quote. Others say that they were offered comfort, not instructions, by the presence, which calmed them and made their decision-making easier. If the imperiled were particularly religious or spiritual, studies found the survivors would refer to the presence as a guardian angel or guiding spirit. Most don't name the angel, but have no doubt that the angel is real. But it's not just religious people who have these experiences. And of course, scientists want to explain how the third person works and why. Oh, those pesky scientists, what with their need for evidence and whatnot. Scientists, even the religious ones, I would wager, are generally not inclined to believe in Jesus taking the proverbial wheel. They look at the brain and what happens to it when it's deprived of sensory input or of human interaction. Turns out it doesn't take long for the human brain to start making shit up. In 1961, researchers at Harvard suspended subjects in a tank of body temperature water and removed all sensory stimuli. After about just 45 minutes, quote, quite normal persons robbed in the tank of all sensory cues begin to do strange things. With the screen of consciousness not filled with sensory images from the environment, the individual himself begins to fill the screen projectively with his own inner uncorrected fantasies, end quote. What's an uncorrected fantasy, you ask? I have no idea. Other studies, as recent as 2023, have found a variety of positive effects from sensory deprivation, including better sleep quality, more original thinking, and increased overall creativity. Anyone with a kid addicted to YouTube can confirm that a constant stream of stimuli makes for a pretty meme-ridden brain. Whereas you take the screen away from them for a day and you start to hear things like, I've been thinking. The dark side of such prolonged deprivation can include an increased incidence of out-of-body experiences and visual or auditory hallucinations. I once did a deprivation tank for about an hour, and all that I experienced was boredom. Maybe it takes more than an hour with no stimulus for most people to start going nuts. Listen, I wouldn't mind some out-of-body experiences because lately I'm unimpressed with most of the in-of-body experiences I'm having. Anyway, the brain likes stuff thrown at it regularly. When it doesn't get that stuff, weird things can happen. History is awash in examples of what happens when the brain isn't fed new information. We'll start with some of the famous and probably the most familiar examples to those of us raised in the U.S. with its Judeo-Christian precepts. I do this because I don't have the time, the desire, or, most importantly, the knowledge to explain every world religion in this space. I hope you understand. You've got Moses, who supposedly went up to Mount Sinai for 40 days and nights without food or water, highly unlikely and also medically inadvisable, and came down with the Ten Commandments. Fair to say that someone who doesn't eat or drink or talk to another person for that long might be on the brink of death and start hallucinating things like burning bushes and a dude telling him the 10 rules for living. Then there's good old Jesus H. Christ, who also spent 40 days on a fast, this time in the desert. For Jesus, it was Satan, rather than God, that came to visit him in his state of extreme deprivation. Satan was like, "How about it, Jesus? You want a little bit of this?" And Jesus was like, "Not today, Bob," and came back more into God than ever. In Islam, the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad through the angel Jibril, aka Gabriel, whom he met while isolating himself in the cave of Hira near Mecca. It was often the Prophet's habit to do so, as he was having transcendental dreams that he was to become the messenger of God. Native Americans were known to take singular journeys into the wilds around them to connect with their familiar spirits, and with the Great Spirit that controlled their fates. And of course, Buddhists do this through meditation and prayer. My point? that it's easy to see why Shackleton and every other polar explorer, for that matter, faced with an unrelenting white and robbed of sensory impressions outside that of being ice cold, with sharp wind numbing the sound of any speech, might not be afraid of a companion who suddenly appears out of thin air to comfort them as they suffer. This goes for every other space or mountain or ocean explorer who has experienced their own third person firsthand. Faith says it's something sent by God. The brain, though, says it's boredom, or loneliness, or fear. Of course, it could be all of the above, or none. Or maybe it's something far more primitive than that. Julian Jaynes, an American psychologist who worked at both Yale and Princeton, wrote his seminal work in 1976, titled The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. The work is, as one podcast noted, quote, not for the intellectually faint-hearted. Neither is his follow-up piece, Hearing Voices and the Bicameral Mind. It's hard sledding to read without a doctorate in this stuff, so let me just cut to the chase. Jaynes basically said that the two hemispheres in our brains didn't talk to each other until about 3,000 years ago. Up till then, there was the right side, or God side, and the left, the man side. So when the God side was talking, the man side didn't know it was his own brain doing the yammering. Take a second to imagine that, please. I have to say, I can't. It is literally unfathomable to me that we used to hear our own thoughts and constantly be like, "Who said that?" It could drive a person crazy. The God side was, I guess, infinitely more practical and apt to make logical decisions and suggest smart choices. It was also in charge of imaginative thinking and creativity. The man side was just standing by and listening. LOL, another unfathomable thing. A man just standing by and listening? This may explain why so many peoples in earlier times believed gods spoke to them. That is, that the voices they heard in their own heads were from out there, when in fact, they were from within. The right side of the brain was the great intruder on the left side's business. Interesting stuff. And so is this. Geiger noted that when he spoke to survivors about their third-person experience, several specifically said that the presence appeared on their right side. Back to the voices. This bicameral thesis might explain, oh, I don't know, Adam and Eve, the Israelites, Joan of Arc, those children who saw the Madonna in Portugal, France, and Bosnia. The list is a long one. Yet does it explain how, more recently, Charles Dickens was influenced by the voices in his head, and that actor Anthony Hopkins says he hears the voice of Sir Laurence Olivier? And does he mean that he literally hears Laurence Olivier, or is it like when I sleep too late and hear my stepmom's voice yelling that she doesn't run a flophouse? Just 5 years ago, Yale School of Medicine researchers went after the problem and in 2022 reported that up to 15% of the general population hears voices that other people don't. And while some voice hearers can be determined to have schizophrenia, many never feel the need to seek help. Is this an evolutionary throwback or just something that exists but people don't really like to talk about? Which is understandable because, as I said earlier, no one wants to admit a voice in their head told them which coffee brand to buy. You feel me? It seems like an experience that would be interesting to have. Not for me, though. Please, I like my solitude. There is so much chatter happening everywhere all the time. The last thing I need is someone who's not even there prattling on at me. Charles Lindbergh said he was neither surprised nor scared of the ghosts that appeared in his fuselage after he'd been in the air for hours, flying solo to Paris from New York. Many years later, he would call them, quote, emanations from the experience of ages. Very mystical for a practical man who was so outwardly straight-laced and conventional, not to mention virulently anti-Semitic and racist. He was no fool, an asshole, maybe, but not a fool. He had taken care of a few things on his flight to make sure his body was not going to be the problem on his 33-hour flight. He packed 5 sandwiches, 2 quarts of water, and 5 cans of Army-issue emergency rations. He made sure his blood sugar stayed well within range, and he stayed hydrated. Not like most of the other folks who heard voices during extreme duress, who were very likely starving and dehydrated. Let's go back to our good friend Sir Ernest and his crewmen who walked across South Georgia to get help. They were, as you'll remember, exhausted, hungry, and in very bad shape. No sandwiches for them. In 1993, Dr. Fiona Godley wrote in the British Medical Journal that the threesome's experiences with a fellow traveler might have been the result of, quote, blood glucose concentrations almost incompatible with life. That is, sugar drop. Too few calories, too much exertion. Anyone who's ever had a kid knows the experience of wondering if they've been suddenly possessed by the devil, when in fact they're just hungry. Godley found that those deficiencies, quote, may have contributed to the mixing of reality and imagination. In his 2015 doctoral dissertation, Henry Raymond Gooley wrote about the medical aspects of the many expeditions that took place in what was known as the Heroic Age of Antarctic Exploration, 1895 to 1922. Gooley quantified the near endless list of things that medically went unattended to in that great vastness of ice and wind. A sampling: wet beriberi, or a thiamine deficiency, scurvy, or a vitamin C deficiency, snow blindness, frostbite, alcoholism, recurring gastrointestinal distress, malnutrition, hypothermia, oxygen deficiency, dental problems, starvation, and a high incidence of suicide. I'd be seeing armies of invisible people by then, but I digress. I don't need a medical degree to see where these guys, though brave, were monumentally challenged. Even I know that when your blood sugar slides, confusion is common. And that, of course, hallucinating that you're not alone in a room is not the sole province of those in dire circumstances. It's something that happens to people with schizophrenia, narcoleptics, and epileptics. Critchley first noted this, but Geiger was the first to say that what differentiated the survivor's illusion of a third person from those conjured by people with brain injury or neuropsychiatric disorder is the absence of delirium. Rationality was still intact for those who remembered the feeling of the sudden appearance of another who came to help them. They knew it was irrational, but they listened anyway, almost amused by the odd encounter, always intrigued by it, anxious to understand what was happening, anxious to figure out who the phantom companion was and why they'd chosen to show up now. Thing is, a lot of people don't need an explanation. Most especially among them are widows and widowers. In repeated studies conducted in various locales around the world, it was found that at least half of those who had been recently deprived of the company of their now dead spouse had sensed their presence. While most of those who experienced it rarely spoke of it to others, as it was seen as silly or desperate, it was determined by researchers to be a rather commonplace occurrence. It didn't matter if the dead spouse was male or female, the occurrence was equally reported. A separate study, as reported in The Third Man Factor, found that it was not just widows and widowers who experienced the return of a loved one, but sometimes the appearance is of a favored relative or friend. The encounters can be short-lived or last a lifetime. Geiger even tells of a woman whose dead husband came back to stay with her a while, then disappeared one day. She reported that she feared he had found another woman. Which is funny, but also so human. Imagine worrying your spouse is cheating on you, even in death. Anyway, the lesson is not lost on experts who continue to study and try to understand the phenomenon as it relates to grief, or maybe even an anticipation of grief, or as Roman Roy calls it, pre-grief. Mountain climber Reinhold Messner, a man who had experienced the return of his dead brother, told Geiger that the encounter provided him a way to, quote, stem the loneliness. He figured it was simply his body's way of, quote, inventing ways to provide company. In other words, people who feel the presence of others aren't experiencing some kind of mental collapse, but are finding ways to adapt to the harshness of their situation. Again, it's proof of our humanity. Adding all these possible causes and triggers, what Geiger calls the widow effect, the muse factor, and the power of the savior, to the pathology of boredom and loneliness, some brain scientists have concluded that we could all be moved to create complete humans from incomplete sensory data. How wonderful that we can do that. But I have one question, and it pertains to the fact that this third-person presence tends most often to show up in those aforementioned dire circumstances. And that is, how do we make that person helpful? How do they figure out how to do for us what we cannot manage to do for ourselves? Science has been busy since Geiger wrote his book. In the September 2020 issue of Adventure Journal, one such study drew particular interest from those who want to learn more and from those who are most likely to experience the third-person phenomenon, being, as the readership was, people drawn to adventure. A few years earlier, Olaf Blanc, a Swiss-German neurologist, and his colleagues were able to replicate the third person's appearance in a laboratory setting. From the journal, quote, "The scientists developed a device that allowed a healthy human test subject to draw a pattern that was then replicated on the subject's back with a slight time delay. The scientists determined that the delay between the subject's movements and the mirrored pattern caused the subject to misidentify the source of sensory and motor input. Essentially, it caused a disconnect between the body position and sense to create the eerie feeling of a ghost in the room. The sensation was so powerful that a few participants even refused to continue the test," end quote. They had, in effect, caused a disconnect between the body and the senses, and the result was a new guy standing behind them. As the Adventure Journal notes, why had those adventurers who had experienced it, on at least one occasion, actually offered their new companion food? Why did Shackleton and Worsley both have the same experience at the same time? And why do the new companions always disappear when rescue is imminent? All good questions. So let me do some recapping. As far as science is concerned, it could be low blood glucose, caloric deprivation, hypoxia, and the oxymoronic combo platter of boredom and need for high alertness that triggers the third person's debut on the scene. Or it's just grief, either experienced or about to be. Our brains are a mess. There are those third-person appearances that baffle because they do more than just show up for a little company. In the very early part of this century, Ron DeFrancesco was a financial trader who had offices on the 84th floor of the World Trade Center's South Tower. On September 11, 2001, the North Tower had already been plowed into by a 747 and was burning. Minutes after the hit, an announcement was made that no one in the South Tower need worry. All was safe. No need to evacuate. DeFrancesco stayed put, called his wife and a friend, then changed his mind. He started to find his way down. And then the second plane angled itself to hit the South Tower between the 77th and 85th floors. The floor he had been working on was gone. Stairwells were blocked. Everything was on fire. Debris rained down, and people were either in shock, panic, or dead. DeFrancesco found a few others, and they worked together as best they could to free themselves of immediate obstacles and decide their next step. They had no time and took a set of stairs that looked in better shape. On their way down, DeFrancesco heard someone call for help, and he and another broker he knew stepped onto the 81st floor to look for him. Smoke overcame them both. Crippled by an inability to breathe and by his own understandable panic, he started to go back down when things got worse. Walls were collapsing. Hurt and disoriented, he lapsed unconscious when a voice told him to get up. The male voice used his name, but he couldn't see anyone near him. "Hey, you can do this," it said now. Then he actually felt it lift him up and lead him to the stairs. Together, they ran through the fire on the stairs, being singed badly, as he continued to push through. When he got to the 76th floor, he felt the presence let go of him. Then DeFrancesco saw some firefighters on their way up the stairs. They told him he'd find help below. Ron DeFrancesco was the last person out of the South Tower just as it began its collapse at 1 minute before 10 a.m. He was one of only four people above the 81st floor to get out. He found himself on Church Street, unsure how he got there, having lost consciousness somewhere along the line, only to be revived at a Manhattan hospital a few days later with burns over 60% of his body. His contact lenses had melted onto his eyeballs. He had a broken bone in his back and a head laceration, but he was alive. A deeply religious man, there is little doubt in his mind that God found a way to save him. He told his hometown news outlet in Thunder Bay, Ontario, quote, "The more secular may believe it was my adrenaline-fueled synapses. Here's what I do know. If I ever heard a voice that clear, that calm, and that forceful telling me to get up, I'll do it. It made me get up, back on my feet, and I followed that voice back into the thickest of the smoke and fire." End quote. A victim of a lot of survivor's guilt, DeFrancesco didn't speak much more about his experiences for some time. But now he has made peace with what happened that day as best one can. He says he knows that what worked for him may not work for everybody, but he knows what he knows. You stay alive, whatever way you can. Maybe that's true even when it's not a matter of life or death. Maybe that's true when we are not even sure there's danger at all. Scientists now say that the feeling that someone is watching you or someone is near when there is no one else around is more common than is reported. Geiger cited the 1986 work done by psychologist Jane Mosselin, who interviewed men at the Argentine Antarctic base as part of a study of those who live in extreme environments. Seems almost all of them had a story about how they sensed they had company when they were posted on a 24-hour shift alone at the building that housed the power plant. These men's accounts were identical to those who worked alone doing meteorological work in the tropics. They'd all mentioned the encounters to the respective medical officers on duty, but none said they'd been spoken to about anything. The presence was palpable, the visions rare but noted, and absolutely none of the encounters were frightening. But wait, some are. Most of the women I know have, at some time or another, felt that someone was following them. They have done all kinds of things to throw this other off. Dropped into coffee shops, turned corners suddenly, asked strange men to walk with them for a bit, but in most cases admit that they never saw or heard anyone there. But we know they could be. Our fear is based on countless true horror stories. We're being smart. I will trust that instinct every time. But it's not the only one of its kind that we have. According to a 2012 piece in Psychology Today, we have all had what experts call anomalous experiences. Think déjà vu. Or maybe those feelings that someone is staring at you, and lo and behold, someone is. Or say you feel strangely like you are outside of your own body. Or you sense a strange temperature or mood shift in a room that is not explicable but is decidedly different. Here's Matthew Hudson, author of The Seven Laws of Magical Thinking, trying to explain what just happened to you. Quote, "The job of the conscious mind is to form a story out of all our sensations and reflections. Life, as we experience it, is not just a series of unconnected thoughts and events. It's a coherent narrative unfolding in an orderly universe. But sometimes we have experiences that don't fit our expectations and may even contradict what science has taught us is possible. In our attempts to accommodate such outlier phenomena, we often turn to unproven forces or entities. We start to believe in the paranormal." End quote. According to Hudson, researchers think it might be a familiarity without a recollection. Or maybe it's a timing issue in the brain where your brain is somehow experiencing something twice. Hence, you think, wait, this has happened to me before, but when? Some believe it's moments from a past life. Of course, we all know the real cause is a glitch in the matrix. Of all the phenomena out there that seems unexplainable, like meaningful coincidences or evidence of psychic abilities or the persistence of near-death experience, Hudson found that, quote, the most compelling evidence of a visitation is what's called a sense of presence, the feeling that an agent is with you, typically less than a few feet away, end quote. But he too found what Geiger found. Quote, fear and loneliness have both been shown to amplify our detection of agents in our environment. They put us on high alert for intruders or companions in our midst, end quote. Okay, but could it also be real? I remain to be convinced it isn't. Same thing with coincidence. Is that just, well, something that happens, or is it something more? Like the gods having fun, or the universe giving a sly wink to what it knows is coming. In his foreword to Geiger's book, Vincent Lamb, a researcher and doctor, wrote about one evening when he'd been studying day and night to take the MCAT. He took a small break to take a shower. In the shower, he sensed a presence. It told him that things would work out. Lamb got out of the shower and wrote down all the practical bits that his guardian angel had also given him. He stored the notes on his computer, on both the hard drive and on a floppy disk. Thing is, when he went to find those later, they didn't exist. I mean, that's not all that spooky. Maybe he forgot to hit save? He became a doctor, which I guess means things did work out, but he also wrote something very wise that I am sure even Shackleton would have found honest and true. Quote, the third man speaks to both the ways in which we are fundamentally alone and to the ways that, as humans, we always contain the possibility of relationship with others. It reassures us that even in the worst of times, help may come, end quote. And oddly enough, a new kind of help has come from using the lessons of the third-person encounters. Psychologists have now found a way to use those stories to help trauma survivors of all kinds manufacture a strong third person to give them guidance, comfort, support, and encouragement when they are experiencing the worst of their symptoms. Some things don't have to be explained to be real. It doesn't have to be real to help. It doesn't even have to be plausible. Help is help, wherever it comes from. Next time on Strange and Unexplained. In the mid-1800s, some black people managed to pass themselves off as white folk in order to reap the privileges not afforded to black folk. But Clarence King, a Yale-educated, celebrated geographer, did it the other way around. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was researched and written by Amy Wilson and me, Daisy Egan. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab. Or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.